1. The legal and regulatory background. It's impossible to give a comprehensive guide to the issue of drug licensing in the EU and the law of the NHS in a short podcast. Is a summary of the relevant issues in order to assist with an explanation to the background to the Avastin litigation. When a company develops a new medicinal product in the EU, which we will refer to as a drug, it registers the intellectual property rights in the drug in order to ensure that no one else can copy the drug and compete in the market. Drugs are given a period of exclusivity, where the IP rights holder is the only company that can manufacture and market the drug in the territories covered by the EU. The term of a patent is generally 20 years from the date on which the application for the patent is filed. However, registering a patent for a medicinal product does not make it lawful for a pharmaceutical company to market their product within the EU. In order lawfully to market a medicinal product in the EU, the company needs to obtain a marketing authorisation from the European Medicines Agency, known as the EMA, under the Medicines Directive. The full title of that directive is Directive 2001/83/EC of the European Parliament and the Council of 6 November 2001 on the Community Code relating to medicinal products for human use. We will refer to this as the Medicines Directive. The Medicines Directive has been amended on a number of occasions since the original text was published in 2001, but it's not necessary to refer to details of the amendments for present purposes. The Medicines Directive has 61 recitals and sets out a complex legislative scheme to govern the manufacture and marketing of medicinal products within the European Union. Article 6 of the directive provides that no medicinal product may be, quote, placed on the market, unquote, of a member state unless a marketing authorisation has been issued. There is a separate system of manufacturing authorisations, which gives permission to holders of the authorisation to manufacture medicinal products. There's no definition in the directive of the meaning of the term placed on the market. It clearly covers the initial action of the pharmaceutical company of making the drug available for wholesale distribution. However, the supply chain for drugs often involves the drug passing through multiple hands before they end up with a doctor who prescribes the drug for a patient. One of the issues in this case was the extent to which each separate step in the supply chain was a separate placing on the market for the purposes of the directive. It also covers the requirement for anyone who is involved in the manufacture of medicinal products to have a manufacturing authorisation. 40.2 provides that a manufacturing authorisation shall be required for both total and partial manufacture and for the various processes of dividing up, packaging or presenting medicinal drugs. It goes on to contain an important exemption for pharmacies. A manufacturing authorisation is not required for the preparation, dividing up, or changes in packaging or presentation of a drug, where these are carried out solely for retail supply by pharmacists in dispensing pharmacies, persons legally authorised to do so by member states in carrying out such processes. Thus, pharmacies are entitled to carry out processes with drugs which, in all other circumstances, would require an EU manufacturer's authorisation, provided that these are activities which are solely for retail supply. The term solely for retail supply is not defined within the directive, and the meaning of that term has become important in this case. The EU has also adopted Regulation 726/2004, which lays down the procedures which have to be followed in order to obtain either a marketing authorisation or a manufacturing authorisation for a medicinal product. The UK government has implemented the terms of the Medicines Directive by passing the Human Medicines Regulations 2012. The wording used in the 2012 regulations is not entirely consistent with the wording of the Medicines Directive. And in some cases, the scope of activities defined in the 2012 regulations appears to be wider than those covered by the Medicines Directive. the issues in the Avastin case was the extent to which the meaning of the words in the 2012 regulations was limited by the scope of the medicines directive, and whether activities which were not within the scope of the medicine directive could nonetheless be caught by the terms of the 2012 regulations. Without getting ahead of ourselves, the approach of the Court of Appeal was to interpret the meaning of the 2012 regulations in accordance with the medicines directive, and therefore to provide that UK domestic law concerning medicines regulation went no wider than the law imposed by the medicines directive. The 2012 regulations define the consequences of any breach of the terms of those regulations. Many of the breaches constitute criminal offences. It is thus really important for anyone involved in the handling or distribution of medical products to understand what is and is not permitted by the 2012 regulations, because a breach could lead to that individual being brought before a criminal court. It is thus really important to know whether the scope of the activities governed by the 2012 regulations is limited to matters within the scope of the medicines directive, and what the medicine directive precisely means, or whether the net has been cast in a wider way, criminalising matters undertaken in the UK, even though these matters are not breaches of the terms of the medicines directive. Medicinal drugs are often referred to as having licences. However, EU law does not govern the way in which doctors and other healthcare professionals use medical products to treat patients. That is entirely a matter for the law of each member state. A license for a drug will define the way in which the pharmaceutical companies can market the drug, but they do not, of themselves, limit the way in which doctors can use drugs. Drugs which only have been licensed for marketing for adults are frequently and entirely lawfully prescribed for children. There are significant ethical problems in undertaking randomised controlled trials of paediatric drugs, and accordingly it's often difficult to get drugs licensed for paediatric use. This means that pharmaceutical companies are not entitled to market an adult drug for use for children. However, once the drug arrives at the hospital, paediatricians are fully entitled to use their clinical judgments to decide what drugs should be used for which patients, including those outside the terms of the marketing authorisation or the licence. Now, in making these decisions, doctors and pharmacists are subject to a series of wholly different regulatory constraints. First, all doctors operating in the UK have to be registered with the General Medical Council, the GMC. The GMC publishes a code of practice, known as Good Medical Practice, which guides how doctors should exercise their professional duties. A doctor who acts contrary to the GMC guidance may be referred by the GMC for professional disciplinary action. But it is not unlawful in the sense that the doctor breaks a legal obligation to which the doctor is subject for a doctor to act contrary to the advice contained in Good Medical Practice. The potential sanction for doing so is not a fine imposed by a criminal court or a finding of liability in a civil court. The potential sanction is disciplinary action in a case brought by the GMC before the Specialist Medical Tribunal. Doctors can be suspended from practice or struck off the register if their fitness to practice is impaired, and acting in breach of the GMC Code of Practice can be evidence of impaired fitness to practice. Pharmacists are subject to regulation by the General Pharmaceutical Council, the GPC, in a similar manner. Hospital doctors are employed by NHS trusts. They will have terms and conditions of their employment and could face disciplinary sanction from their employers if they act in breach of the terms of their contract of employment. Equally, all doctors in practice are potentially liable to their patients for any negligent action on their part. However, in practice, any negligence liabilities will be picked up by the indemnity policies held by their hospital trust and will not result in the doctor facing any personal sanction. Lastly, by way of background, it is important to say something about the way the NHS is structured. The NHS systems are set up by the National Health Service Act 2006 as amended by the Health and Social Care Act 2012 and a series of other domestic statutes, involve a large number of different public bodies. The Secretary of State for Health and Social Care sits at the apex of the NHS pyramid, discharging his role under the NHS Acts. However, the Secretary of State has largely a political and strategic role. The structures deliberately ensure that, save in the case of an emergency, precise decisions about which medical treatment should be provided to which patient and in what way are made by medical professionals and not politicians. The Secretary of State for Health and Social Care has wider obligations than as the Cabinet member responsible for the NHS. One such role is in connection with medicines regulation. The Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency, known as the MHRA, is the executive agency responsible for ensuring safety and efficacy of medicines in the UK. MHRA has no separate legal personality from the Secretary of State and is, in effect, the national organisation which gives effect to EU obligations as set out in the Medicines Directive. The MHRA issues licences to carry out certain functions in the UK with respect to medicines to the extent that's permitted under the Medicines Directive. There is no single legal organisation called the NHS, as there is, for example, in the case of a local authority. The NHS is made up of a very large number of different legal organisations who work together as a result of a complex series of contractual and statutory arrangements. The NHS can be roughly divided into regulators, commissioners, and providers. There are two types of commissioner: NHS England, which is a national commissioner, and locally based clinical commissioning groups. Clinical commissioning groups, known as CCGs, are membership organisations made up of the NHS GP practices in a particular area. The role of the CCGs is to enter into a series of contracts with a range of provider organisations that deliver care to NHS patients, so that the NHS is able to deliver as comprehensive a service as possible to NHS patients. NHS England is both a regulator and a commissioner of specialised services. Thus, CCGs do not directly provide any services to NHS patients. They are strategic bodies who seek to organise the services in their area, making sure that each provider organisation is working effectively to deliver the service that each patient needs, and that those services are delivered in accordance with the terms of the contracts put in place between the CCGs and provider organisations. NHS Trusts and NHS Foundation Trusts are medical provider organisations. They are public bodies that run hospitals, community services, and mental health services. They contract with both NHS England and with CCGs to provide these services to patients, but they provide services to patients free at the point of use. GP practices contract with NHS England, although many CCGs now handle GP contracting for their areas on behalf of NHS England. Accordingly, CCGs set the broad strategic framework for the delivery of NHS services in their area, and they adopt policies about how NHS services should be delivered. But decisions about precisely how NHS care is to be delivered in a hospital are taken by hospital trusts and the doctors that are employed by the hospital trust, not by the CCG. CCG policies can influence the way that hospitals deliver care to NHS patients, but in the end, the trust, not the CCG, is the final decision maker about how and what care should be delivered. Trusts will only get paid by the CCG for care which is delivered in accordance with the contracts they have in place between the CCG and the trusts. But these contracts give a large element of clinical freedom to the hospital trust to decide who should receive what care and how that care is to be delivered. The important distinction in decision-making between CCGs and trusts were very significant to the outcome in the Avesta litigation. It's perhaps important to say at the outset that these distinctions were always clearly understood by those operating within the NHS and those advising the NHS, but it is possible that the significance of these distinctions was not fully appreciated by parties outside the NHS. End of our introduction to the legal and regulatory background, we next invite you to click on the next podcast, which explains the position relating to wet AMD patients.